The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. MidwayUSA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. This is the 221st episode, and today we're going to be talking about Pebble Mine. But before we get to that and some of the reasons why we're talking about that, I did want to address the elephant in the room. That is to say, the way I sound. Probably not the normal voice you're used to hearing, and that's because I was at the fly fishing show both in Marlborough, Massachusetts and in Edison, New Jersey over the last 2 weekends, and a small bit of congestion is a modest price to pay for all the hands I shaked and all the conversations I had and all the good times I had with so many fantastic people in fly fishing. And the fact of the matter is, you spend 2 weekends out in the wintertime, and there's a very good chance you're going to get something. So I'd do it all over again if I had the opportunity. But a little bit of congestion, a little bit of tea to keep me going as I talk for the next 20 minutes. But I was going to talk about the fly fishing show today on the podcast. But then something important happened, something exciting happened, and that is the striking down of the Pebble Mine project in Alaska. Now, there's a very good chance that if you have zero social media presence, that if you only listen to a couple of podcasts, if you'll listen to this podcast, and you maybe stop in a fly shop now and again, you are aware of what Pebble Mine is in general terms and the fact that most anglers are against the thing happening. The anti-Pebble Mine stickers and patches and signs and logos. It's the big, you know, do not cross logo with Pebble Mine in it, have become ubiquitous. You see them all over the place, everywhere from water bottles to fly shop windows to the bumpers of trucks with rod bolts on them. It's all over the place. So this is something that has been well covered and has been given the attention that it deserves. And the fact of the matter is that for at least 10 years, the current actions that inevitably led to it being shut down and being canceled by the EPA have been something that have been actively pursued by Trout Unlimited and by a number of other agencies. But before we get into the fact that it is canceled, which is seen as a great victory and a wonderful thing by many, not just in the fly fishing world, but in conservation, in sport fishing, in commercial fishing, in wildlife conservation in general, as well as in those who want to preserve Alaska for what it is, let's talk a little bit about what in the world Pebble Mine was supposed to be, where it was, and why it was such a hot button issue. Now, something I do want to address before I get into that is that I have the flexibility as being a relatively small operation at Casting Across of hopping right into this, you know, having a plan to have one podcast episode and shifting really fast. I'm kind of a canoe out in the water. I can quickly turn 90 degrees. Some of the big fly fishing podcasts are going to do some really good stuff, I anticipate, in the coming days, weeks, and months regarding what happened at Pebble Mine. And some of those podcasts, if you go back in their archives, you can inevitably find things where they're talking about the fight as it's happening, and they're doing so with the conservationists, the biologists, and the activists that were actively working on shutting Pebble Mine down and have ultimately succeeded. And so I would absolutely encourage you to go seek those things out, but keep listening to what I talk about because it'll give you that primer so that some of the vocabulary will hopefully come naturally to you as you listen to those things, or by all means, go and read things online. There's so much written, and there's things that are written from a non-fly fishing perspective, which can be helpful as well. So just a little bit of an encouragement and an aside before I get into the podcast. So where was Pebble Mine going to be? Well, it's going to be in Alaska. Alaska's a big place, though. So where in Alaska was it? So if you're looking at Canada and she's looking back at you, hanging off her right shoulder is Alaska. And drooping down off the middle of the state, the very south-central part of Alaska, is that archipelago, that string of islands with a peninsula that connects to the main body of Alaska, the continental United States. And it swings down kind of at a southwesterly direction. But right at the base of that peninsula, up into the heart of Alaska, is where Pebble Mine was going to be. And it was to mine elements like copper and gold, as well as something called, molybdenum, I think is what it is. I mean, thus concludes the extent of my knowledge of chemistry. But these are chemicals, and these are, elements that are incredibly valuable across the various industries. Obviously, technology is a huge consumer of something like gold. It's, not just for pretty necklaces and earrings and things like that. Copper is something that is used in building as well as in technology. They are things that have good, valuable uses. And it was found in the 1980s that this area of Alaska was rich in these elements. In fact, people believe that this would be, had it been tapped into, the second largest ore deposit of its kind in the entire world, which is pretty significant when you consider the size of the entire world. But where this area sits is, ecologically speaking, diverse, remarkable, and majestic, to use only a few different superlative words. What's going on there? Well, this is classic Alaska. This is not cold, frozen tundra. This is woods and mountains and rivers and bays and grizzlies and caribou and moose and all of the things that you would expect in Alaska. Moreover, it is an area that has a significant population of people, given where we're talking about. Not significant by like East Coast standards, but a significant part of Alaska as far as human population go. And a lot of the industry is directly tied to the land. And this in particular is why fly fishing causes, organizations, brands, things like that, have taken up the mantle of defending the area against the Pebble Mine. In fact, one of the remarkable things about Bristol Bay, which is the area that is the downstream drainage from where the proposed Pebble Mine site is, which was something we'll talk about here in a moment, it is the largest sockeye salmon spawning habitat in the world. The largest sockeye salmon spawning habitat in the world. But along with sockeyes, there's also chinooks, cohos, chums, pinks. Every species of Pacific salmon that is found in Alaska is found in Bristol Bay, is found in the watershed that is downstream from the proposed Pebble Mine site. And this is why it's an issue, because everything that happens upstream has an impact downstream. Everything that you do upriver is going to have an impact downriver. And mining is no small thing. Now, mining is something that has been happening around the world since we looked at the ground and said, I wonder what's down there. Or we see something on top of the ground, we pick it up and we see another one underneath it and we think, well, I imagine there's more even beneath that. So there's nothing inherently unethical about mining. Let's just get that straight. There's a lot of people who have carved out, literally, a life through mining and doing so ethically. That being said, as technology has increased, we can look in the East Coast of the United States, places where I've spent a lot of time West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania, for example. And you can see how the technology has outpaced the understanding of the implications of the use of that technology. And so you have entire mountainsides being devastated, and it's not just a mountain that's gone, but there's great impact to the surrounding area. And when we're thinking about water, what happens to that watershed that it is immediately sitting around that project and downstream. So the proposed Pebble Mine project, the mine that was going to go in there, it would have not just had a significant impact because of the infrastructure that would have had to go in. I mean, that itself is concerning. That itself is something that causes environmental protection groups, whether it be the EPA or a state organization, to hold up projects, to hold up programs, because a road that is being put in next to a stream or over a watershed is going to be too significant of an impervious surface. And it's going to cause problems with drainage. It's going to cause problems with flow. It's going to cause all sorts of issues. And imagine the amount of road, bare minimum, that would have to go to a mining project that was going to be any significant size to get the equipment in, to get the ore out. So you're not just talking about digging a hole in the ground. A lot more is happening. And so that is ultimately what led to the concern for this project. It would mar the landscape, so there would be an aesthetic issue, and there would be an irreversible damage that would happen to that part of Alaska in the headwaters of Bristol Bay. But then everything that would have taken place up in that area would have had a significant impact downstream. And I think that salmon and rainbow trout and other things that live in that water are a perfect example of how that could have a devastating impact. Because you do mining, and even if there is 95%, and this is all complete conjecture, 95% remediation of things like siltation. So you blow up a rock, you move a bunch of soil, and all the soil that you don't fully removed from that area that goes to the ground, now at the very bare minimum is able to be washed into that water body or immediately filters down into that water body. And now that all enters at an extremely exaggerated rate than would otherwise happen under normal weather conditions, enters the water. Eventually, over time, all of the accumulated substrate, whether it be silt or something else, is going to impede the ability of fish to spawn because they are unable to lay their eggs into the environment they're supposed to be in, the rocky substrate of the bottom of the stream. And that's just one example. There are significant other issues that happen because, as you may know, they don't use pickaxes anymore to do mining. There is often not just heavy equipment, but there are chemical processes that are used to extract minerals from the ground. And so there are other things that can leach in to the, not just the surrounding soil and cause problems to the land, but all, of course, also in the water. And we know how it spreads much more quickly. And a land animal can move, but a aquatic animal doesn't have that same sort of flexibility. But one of the bigger issues that we find when it comes to mining is acid mine drainage. So when you mine, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but I had a really good friend who was involved in a project to do acid mine remediation in Pennsylvania because that was a significant issue. And he talked me through it years and years ago, and it really stuck with me because it's something that we don't even really think about, but it plays a significant role whenever we are living in an industrial or post-industrial area. And what it is that you have these chemicals that are being used in the mining, but you also have, in a more significant aspect, when you are mining, you are releasing compounds into above the ground and into the water that would otherwise take a long time to dissolve into the water, and they would go into the water body at much lower levels in a way that actually maintains that natural pH balance. But when they are released all at once because all of these chemicals and all of these minerals that are being exposed through mining now are A, in the particulate form that I mentioned earlier, and B, are being exposed to water because aquifers often get broken into, or because of water being used as a lubricant in mining. All of those acids are now entering into the water body. Now, you might have seen this if you live out east and you see yellow rivers, you see yellow creeks or orange creeks. And what you see there is all these dissolved metals that were underground, but that were exposed through mining, are now leaching out and coming out into contact with rivers. And they effectively coat the bottom of rocks. I mean, you might pick up a small rock and it looks like it is just an orange rock, but the reason why it's orange is not because it's changed color, it has been coated by a mineral. And this is hostile for macroinvertebrates, it's hostile for plants, and it creates new species, find a niche there, including like iron-eating algae. I mean, if you want a nightmare, think about that, algae that eats iron. But there's some really interesting things that you can read about acid mine drainage and remediation online. But that was going to be a significant problem because of the Pebble Mine project. So that is a very, very brief nutshell of what we were looking at when it came to the issue of Pebble Mine in South Central Alaska. There was arguments for it, of course. The arguments against it were very clear. It would take away jobs with commercial fishing. It would take away jobs from lodges and guides and things like that. It would have significant environmental impacts, both long-lasting from a viability standpoint of the ecosystem, as well as an aesthetic standpoint for a part of the country, really, and the state that has a significant tourism aspect that's built upon aesthetic beauty. Now, there were those that had arguments for the mine. Significant tax revenue for Alaska. Alaska is not, blowing, Silicon Valley or the New England area out of the water when it comes to states with high yield. And so this would have brought significant income to the state of Alaska. And it would also have created jobs. Can only be so many anglers for commercial fishing. There can be only so many foresters for forestry. But this would have created a number of jobs. And it would have created more independence from foreign access to these kind of minerals that we would be getting access to. So those are all pros, and they all are legitimate. I mean, none of those things is bad or wrong in itself. The question is, what was the cost? What was the cost? And so I don't want to go through, nor do I have the time to go through blow by blow everything that happened from the like late 2000s, like 2008-09, when the DNR started fighting against it in Alaska, all the way up to January 31st. But there was a lot of back and forths. And there were back and forths under both Democratic and Republican administrations. In fact, there was a significant stoppage to the progress of Pebble Mine under the Trump administration. So, you know, if you're somebody who likes to paint with broad brushes, you know, figure that one out. But really, to draw it back in to today and this week, on January 31st, the EPA blocked the development of the mine, and they did that by invoking Section 404C of the Clean Water Act. Now, 404C of the Clean Water Act is effectively a way for the EPA to step in and say that what would happen here if this continued would be a significant consequential action that would cause irreversible damage to the area. There's much more technical language that could be used, but it is effectively the EPA, a federal organization, coming in and saying this is not a tenable project because it would have too much damage on the local environment. Now, well, Northern Dynasty, which is, I should have mentioned that earlier, the company that had for the last, 15 years or longer than that, had been managing the Pebble Mine project. Are they going to appeal? Of course they're going to appeal. But for all intents and purposes, what it appears like now is that this is a significant wall and a hurdle that will be very, very difficult to jump for them to get this project back up and running. So it is seen as a victory. Of course, there's always some wariness because we know, or I should say we don't know how the courts work, but it is should be seen as something good in the sense that this area is going to be preserved and protected. Now, that being said, I don't want to like throw a wrench and stuff, but just a couple of things to think about. A couple of things for you to think about as you are maybe reveling in this news, or if you're just trying to figure out what happened. The first thing is, notice I said earlier that this is a significant area for commercial fishing, and the commercial fisheries have been co-belligerents with the recreational catch and release fly anglers from the get-go. Now, if you are such a tried and true Tweed and Creel creed. I guess I could talk about that. But anyway, if that is your, like, it's got to be catch and release or it's the devil, know that the co-belligerents in this process of getting Pebble Mine shut down, some of the strongest advocates have been the sport fishing and more importantly, the commercial fishing industries. People who kill fish, you know, by the boatful have been the ones who've been fighting to shut down Pebble Mine. So figure that out. I think it's a pretty consistent argument. I think it's understandable and how it works, but it's one of those things where, again, if you are very black and white when it comes to this stuff, you have to realize that the people that probably won it weren't this tiny little group of anglers. They're probably a powerful group of commercial fishers who were supplying wild salmon, which, my goodness, if there's something that is not good in this world in that swims in the ocean, it is farm-raised salmon. So the wild salmon commercial fishers are co-belligerents, and you got to be okay with that. Another thing to think about is, guess what? This was on public land. One of the battle cries, especially for the last 10 years, but certainly going back further, was, you know, public land, public land, public land. Well, this was happening on public lands. Northern Dynasty simply had the mining rights to public land owned by the state of Alaska. So public land is not a get out of jail free card, is not a fail safe for environmental issues. There has to be more to it than that, because states and the federal government operate in their best interest. They have to weigh the balance between the interests of their state and the state's economy, as well as interests that revolve around ecological and conservation issues. And so just because something is public land, it might be accessible. And sometimes, you know, I think that is the assumption. It's accessible, it's protected. Well, it might be accessible and protected, but there's a good chance that unless it has a certain designation attached to it, the state's okay with folks going in there and cutting down trees for the right amount of money or digging a giant hole for the right amount of money. So I don't say that to be cynical. I just say that to remind people that public land does not equal safe today, safe tomorrow, safe forever. Because I think sometimes we can think that public land is some sort of magic designation that we can put on to land and it keeps it safe. Just a couple of things to think about when it comes to this. But like I said, total scratching of the surface. It wouldn't surprise me if there's, like I said, multiple podcasts. There's already a lot of articles out there. This has the makings of a great little Netflix documentary. And I don't think anyone gets murdered, which would make it unique among their catalog of documentaries. So I would definitely check that one out, because it's bare minimum, it's a stunningly beautiful part of the world and certainly part of the country. And it's worth looking at and seeing these enormous runs of fish. I mean, you have to remember that one of the big battles that we're fighting here in the contiguous United States, the lower 48, is just the reduced number of salmon that are making their way into our coastal waters. This is happening unimpeded up there, even with the significant amount of commercial fishing that's being regulated to maintain these huge stocks. And so, you know, if you could take significant action hundreds of years ago in California or in Maine to stop what was happening, to alter drastically these salmon fisheries, would you have stood up for it? Would you have slapped that sticker on the back of your laptop case that has the cross and the project on it? Hopefully you would have, but you would have thought about it and you would have been consistent in the way that you think about that and other conservation issues. So check out Pebble Mine, what isn't happening, and how that's good. This week on castingacross.com, the first article is called Three Ways to Learn at the Fly Fishing Show. Three Ways to Learn at the Fly Fishing Show. This is my clarion call, my attempted clarion call, for people to not just go and walk around the fly fishing show. And I think I talked about this a few weeks ago on the podcast, but I feel like I just got to keep saying it, because it bothers me when people say, I don't want to go. People just want me to spend more money. If you're spending money to get in, then take advantage. Get every cent of your $15 or $25 worth as you go in and you look at the stuff, which is fun, and do it. But then go sit down. I force myself to do it just because I always talk about it. I forced myself to go and sit in seminars I wouldn't have otherwise sat in, and I had a blast. I wish I could have stuck around for another, you know, day and a half to catch more of them. But there's different kinds of presentations, and so I talk about the different kinds of presentations in this article, so check that one out. Wednesday's was called Fishing Shopping in Person or Online. Now, I'm kind of bracing for the digital tomatoes to be thrown, because I do make three cases for why you should shop online as opposed to a fly shop, but they are measured, they are responsible, they are in defense of fly shops generally, but there's folks that, and I even saw it today when I was on Instagram, were just like, you know, never buy online. There's times and places and circumstances that warrant shopping online. And so I talked about that. In case you feel like you are doing some great disservice to the idea of fly shops or your local fly shop because you bought, you know, some flies from somebody online or a product from Amazon. And so I walk through that. Again, I love fly shops. I support fly shops. Some exciting fly shop stuff coming from Casting Across in the coming weeks. So stay tuned. But all that to say, there are times where you can buy stuff online and you shouldn't feel bad about it. This week's recommendation on the podcast is Squala. Squala is an outdoor clothing company specializing in fly fishing clothing and systems that are built from the fabric up. Now, why am I talking about Squala? Squala had probably the most aesthetically pleasing and organized booth in all of the Edison, New Jersey fly fishing show. That is not meant to denigrate anyone else's booth. Just Squala's was top notch, and their floor was soft, which after a day and a half of walking around concrete, a nice soft flooring material is going to go a long way in my book as far as the quality of your booth. But when I talk about built from the fabrics up, the attention to detail in what fabric is used where on everything from hooded sunshirts all the way to premium waders is done with exceptional attention to detail. And so I strongly encourage you to check out Squala. If you have a local fly shop that carries their stuff, then definitely go in there and give it a touch and a feel. So high quality. I'm looking forward to talking to them here in the coming weeks and putting something together for Casting Across. But just had a real, real good time talking with a couple of reps from their company. And it's the kind of company doing the kind of thing that I want people to check out. So I'm definitely encouraging you to head over to their website. I'll put a link to Squala on the show notes to this podcast page over at castingacross.com. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe to your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast on iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for three posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV. In Wild Country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.